Hello and welcome. I am your host, Goblin Queen. On the day this is uploaded, we are just a few days from Halloween, my personal favorite holiday. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. All of the stories tonight took place on Halloween. Not only are we going to be talking about Halloween, we are also going to be talking about fairies, another favorite topic of mine. Fairies and Halloween have a long history together. We'll go into that tonight. So we will read some stories, some from Reddit, some from the Fairy Census, maybe from some other sources as well. And I'm also going to read from a couple of books because we're going to go into, of course, some folklore and some history. But of course, that will all come in between first-hand paranormal experiences. So let's get started. We are going to start with the paranormal subreddit. And this one was submitted by a singular bean. This took place on Halloween night, 2006. I was 14 at the time and spending the night at my friend Heather's house, along with two other friends. We were all going to spend the evening trick-or-treating in Heather's neighborhood. Heather had three siblings there as well, including her brother Eli. Eli was the annoying younger brother who had a crush on me, and anytime we would have sleepovers there, he would go into my things and steal my clothing or whatever he could get his weird hands into. This is relevant to the story, I promise. Heather, Eli, and another sister all had their bedrooms in the basement. Eli and the other sister's rooms were at the end of a hallway past Heather's room, which was midway down the hall to the right. Everyone got into their Halloween costumes and makeup and started to gather in the front yard of the house. I'm outside and realize I forgot my trick-or-treat bag. I got ready in the sister's room, so I ran back into the house to go grab my bag. I rush downstairs, down the hall, and pass Heather's room. Out of the corner of my eye, I notice someone sitting on the edge of Heather's bed, staring down at the floor. The lights were off, but the hallway light was on, so even though the room was dark, I could easily see the silhouette of someone quite small, with an extra-large head for their body, just sitting there, staring down. I didn't think much about it in the moment. I immediately figured it was Eli, sitting there, going through my things, as he always did. He was also wearing a costume with a large round mask. Maybe he looked so much smaller because he was sitting at a weird angle, or it was a trick of the eye. It looked odd, but it couldn't have been anyone else. I also thought it strange and quickly took note how unusually black and solid the figure was, and how they had absolutely zero features of any kind to be seen. It made me mad, but I was also too shy and non-confrontational to call him out on it. So I grabbed my bag from the sister's room and rushed past Heather's room again. I was going to rat on him to his parents, so I made sure to look out of the corner of my eye again to make sure he was in there as I went past. The figure was still sitting there, looking down at the floor. I get outside and immediately start going off at Heather, telling her that Eli was in her room right now, going through my bag. I was super mad, but she looks confused. She goes, you were the only one in the house. Everyone is outside waiting for you, and points to her brother standing down the road with his group of friends. I felt super uneasy learning that, and she was right. Everyone had been outside waiting for me. There was no way it could have been him inside. He would have had to run past me out of the same door. And I know I saw someone or something sitting on her bed. Heather and her siblings were always scared of being downstairs, especially by themselves, and had mentioned that they thought it might be haunted or that there was something weird going on, especially since their parents had started renovating the house. They noticed a lot more activity around that time. So I'm curious, for those who made it to the end of my story, what do you think this small, large-headed, pitch-black, featureless thing was? I grew up in central British Columbia, Canada, where our First Nations people have stories of little people. My initial feeling has always been an alien entity of some sort. Anyway, I'm open to suggestions. Very creepy Halloween story. Unfortunately, no one really commented on this story with their suggestions of what this figure might have been, so we'll have to muse on that a little ourselves. The witness said they always felt it was an alien. I wonder if that is due to the figure seeming to have an overly large head, as depictions of short-statured gray aliens so often do. I'd be interested to know if there was anything else about it that made them think that it was an alien. They also said, I grew up in central British Columbia, Canada, where our First Nations people have stories of little people. From what I can tell, many, if not all, of the indigenous communities of North America have stories and traditions regarding little people, which can be likened in many ways to Western European fairies, gnomes, elves, goblins, and the like. The names, physical details, and nature of these little people differ from region to region, but generally they resemble humans who are about 2 feet tall, or knee-high to an average adult person. Sometimes they're helpful and benevolent and do things like guiding lost children out of the woods and back to their families. Other times, they are dangerous and will attack people with flint arrowheads who approach their mound dwellings, dealing crippling and sometimes deadly blows. An excerpt from a paper by Lawrence Barkwell about little people folklore among the Métis says, "It is the belief of Métis and other Aboriginal people that the little people live along riverbanks, the sandhills by large lakes, and in caves. They like to live under rock. They are responsible for making the pictographs drawn on the rock faces along the edge of the Cambrian Shield. The little people are there to protect you. If you see one, your luck will change. If you feel sad or sick, you will feel better. Sometimes they venture into urban areas, mostly to visit the native people. They are the reason your everyday objects go missing. They are said to particularly like shiny objects and will take tinfoil or spoons and other cutlery out of people's homes. They also like to eat sweets. For this reason, Métis will put out sugar, candies, and tobacco as offerings to them in places they are known to frequent. If one is camping on a lake shoreline and hears noises coming from the ground at night, this is believed to be the little people working." So, when I was trying to dive into as many stories about the little people as I could, I was led down a glorious rabbit hole that I will have to save and drag you down another time because I'd like to do some more thorough research, but so many interesting among the different Native American tribes. In the meantime, let's get back to our Halloween tales. So the only comment left under the story we just read, our first story, suggests that maybe the entity the witness saw sitting on the bed was a shadow person. And the witness does note how unusually black and solid the figure was, and that they had no discernible features. These details do fit common descriptions people attribute to shadow people, being blacker than black. Now, what exactly a shadow person is, I don't precisely know. I'm familiar with the term, of course, because if you're interested in the paranormal, you're going to hear about shadow people. But I haven't really tapped into exactly what they are supposed to be. I think most people say they're some sort of malevolent, non-human entity. Shadow people stories aren't really something that I found too much interested in this point, for the most part, but I've also never had a shadow person experience, so that probably would change my interest level if I had, or if I do. And it's always subject to change what my particular focus of interest is. So maybe there'll be something that really gets me interested in shadow people at one point. Let me know if you have any personal musings or ideas or experiences with shadow people. And also, this person said they're open to suggestions about what this entity was that they saw. So let me know what you think. Was it a fairy? Was it an alien? Shadow person? Something else? Let's read some more stories, shall we? The next story, also from the paranormal subreddit, was submitted by Blue Skull, and it's called A Visitor on Halloween Last. Last year was very interesting, and it happened in part because I did something stupid. I come from Celtic ancestry, so I grew up being very interested in Celtic tradition and our more pagan roots, even though my parents were very devout Protestants. They allowed me the interest, mainly because they liked connecting more with their roots. So, as I'm sure many of you have read in the common Samhain articles that make their rounds every year since the internet began, that there are a few games and practices that Celts participated in on Samhain every year. The whole holiday is about playing with ghosts and making contact to ask questions, always in a respectful manner. In my household, and my wife's household, most commonly you would always light a fire, inside or outside, depending on where you were gathered, and sometimes leave out candy or other goodies on your doorstep after trick-or-treating was over, or bury them in the planter next to the front door. The burying I've found is a key for the distinction that you're leaving a treat for the dead. Herein lies my screw-up. It was near the end of the night. Trick-or-treating had ended a little while ago, and I realized I hadn't put anything out as we got back and went inside, so I went to the kitchen and looked for something quick to put out. I prefer grabbing apples for this task. A lot of the traditional Samhain games and customs are described as being done with an apple, bobbing for apples, the peel game. So I use an apple when leaving treats for the dead, as they clearly seem to have an affinity for them. I look into the bowl that sits on the nook table and realize that I hadn't bought new apples since I had picked them myself. And though they weren't rotten, you could still see some soft spots begin to form. I thought to myself that this shouldn't be a really big deal, as more than likely it would just be dug up by some animal later. So I grabbed the best-looking one of the bunch, which I still probably wouldn't have eaten without some considerable paring. I stepped out the front door and down the stairs of my house, grabbed the gardening spade sticking out from one of my wife's planters, and scooped a quick hole out in the dirt next to the bottom stair, tossing in the apple and recovering it. I don't know why I still buried the thing. I should have just left it on the stoop, but it was done, so I went back inside and promptly forgot about it. Later that night, the kids were in bed, and my wife and I were watching Trick or Treat, our all-time favorite movie to watch Halloween night. It must have been near midnight when we hear three knocks on our front door. Our home is not a huge house, but it is a pre-Great Depression colonial, so it retains some key features that, though 100 years old, are more upscale features on new homes today. This includes our heavy wood front door and brass door knocker, which is quite loud. It's easy to overdo it when you use the door knocker. You can typically hear it from upstairs with minimal effort. The weird thing was that these knocks were not that typical, loud, resonant knock. They were even and just loud enough for us to hear from our spot near the foyer on the couch. The unusual quietness of the door knocker made the hair stand up on the back of my neck. My wife and I froze and looked at each other. Her level of belief is slightly higher than mine, though not by much, but she's still usually quick to explain things away. Still, it was a little too uncanny. "Do you think there's still any trick-or-treaters out?" she asked. It had been a mild Halloween compared with other years, so she was wondering, as was I, if any wayward trick-or-treaters had simply decided to try their luck on the way home. I had probably forgotten to turn off the porch lights. My first thought, if I'm being honest, was older kids more interested in tricks than treats. "Let's just ignore it," I said. "I'm not interested in answering that." As if in response to my statement, three more knocks came from the door, this time a little louder. I got up and went to the foyer quietly. I had a bit of the shivers now. My wife, who was also a little on edge at this point, whispered as loudly as she could behind me, "Tell me you weren't answering that door." I assured her I was just going to have a look. It's only 10 or so feet to the foyer from where we were seated by the fireplace and TV. I stepped into the foyer. I say foyer, but it's really just a small entryway with a coat closet and a door on each side. Useful as a kind of airlock during really hot or cold times of year, but most of the time, the door leading in just hangs open, as it was now. Right as I was crossing into the foyer, the knock sounded again. Loudly. I jumped mid-step and then rushed up to the small eye-level window in the front door. There was no one standing there. The window doesn't offer great visibility, but with some maneuvering, it's possible to see the whole stoop in front of the door, which is what I was doing now. Nobody was there. If it were someone knocking and then running, I'd have probably caught them in the window to the left of the foyer entrance, or my wife would have seen them outside the living room window to the right. I quietly asked her if she had seen anyone run by. When she answered no, I said, "The only way there's someone there right now is if they're pressed up against the door." My wife quickly asked, "You aren't going to open it, are you?" "Absolutely not," I answered. I still had that feeling that something uncanny was going on, and whether that was a living person or not on the other side of the door, opening it was a bad idea. I went back and pressed my head into the windows on other side of the front room of the house to see if I could see anything on the front step against the doorway. I still couldn't see anything. I went back to the couch, relaxing a little. My wife was very suspicious of the knocks. She seemed to be leaning towards the visitor being not of the living, and told me as much, but we didn't have any knocks after that, and decided to call it a night after the movie ended. A few days later, my wife had been complaining about catching the slightest hint of a dead animal smell when arriving or leaving the house, and the last couple nights we had received phantom knocks at the door, the same light tapping of the door knocker. I had even opened the front door once to find no one there. Then a cloud of gnats showed up. They swarmed just over the end of the flower bed, across from the door and at the end of the path to the driveway, away from where I had buried the apple. They didn't leave that one little area over the flower bed, not even after it snowed pretty heavily. I was amazed they were still alive, considering the season and temperature. All of these little things were beginning to add up, and I had come to a possible conclusion before my wife. I had done a little bit of research to find out if gnats were associated with heralding a certain entity, but I didn't really find anything. My wife began to get really creeped out by the knocking. It had been a couple weeks since Halloween, and she had heard a knock on the door when I was at work. She asked me why I thought this was going on and what I thought might stop it. I then told her I had buried the apple this year. I also told her, because it was bothering me a little now, that it was less fresh than I'd have liked. Let's say she was a little less than pleased to hear this. I assured her at this point that it was still a very edible apple, but this did not dissuade her from her outrage. "That doesn't matter," she said. "You probably attracted a demon or bad fairy." Frankly, though, I thought she was probably right. But whatever it was, it hadn't been invited in, so it was just hanging out outside, reminding us it was still there every few nights. I dug up what was left of the apple and got rid of it. She immediately contacted a friend of hers, a Reiki master, to cleanse the house, which she did. The most interesting thing is that almost immediately after that, the cloud of gnats just disappeared. It's how we had decided we would know whether or not we were in the clear. And that was it. Never will I ever bury rotten fruit on Halloween again. I stick to just leaving out the candy bowl overnight these days. I thought that was a very fun and spooky story. Now, I have to admit, I'm not sure about the gnats. Those kind of seem like they could just be related to the rotten apple. But there are some other interesting parts of this story, and I would like to take some time to break down some of the elements and references that were made throughout this narrative. So first of all, they bring up Samhain, which, if you don't know, is the Irish word for Halloween. In pre-Christian Celtic Ireland, it marked the start of winter, which began on November 1st. Folklorist Jack Santino says, in the old Celtic calendar, Samhain was the high point, the most important festival of the year. The Gaelic name for Halloween is Wya Hawna, and in Welsh it's Nos Skin Calen Gaeaf. It's also called Hap Chune in the Isle of Man. In their story, Blue Skull says, the whole holiday is about playing with ghosts and making contact to ask questions, always in a respectful manner. The presence of ghosts was definitely a big part of Samhain. It was believed to be a night when the souls of the dead could walk the earth. In his book, The Hallowed Eve, Jack Santino interviews two men in Northern Ireland about the old Halloween parties of their youth. One man says, in Ireland and other places, possibly in Wales, maybe in Scotland, the Isle of Man, Halloween was also known as All Souls' Night. All souls were supposed to be out and about, the dead souls. The games, I think, all seemed to hinge on ghosts. Another man says, oh yeah, all souls. The games really did concentrate on the talk with ghosts. They were telling stories. The stories they would tell would be ghost stories. Frightening people, really. The kids would all love it because they would be screaming and frightened, pretending they were all terribly frightened. A lot of the Halloween traditions and games had divinatory purposes, such as girls finding out who they were going to marry, and finding out who was going to die the upcoming year. Also, they were just great fun. This was the biggest and most important social festival of the year. Here's what Marie Trevelyan has to say about it in her book of collected Welsh folklore and customs. Nos Skin Calen Gaeaf, All Saints' Day or All Hallows' Eve, was a time of much festivity in the principality. In the days of old, it was attended by many superstitious rites and ceremonies. A huge log was thrown on the fire for purposes of heat and light. As a rule, the only illumination of the great farmhouse kitchen was that of the ruddy fire glow. All sorts of tricks were performed, and charms were tried. All kinds of games were the order of the evening. When the people were tired, they congregated around the old hearth and became attentive and sometimes scared listeners, while the aged grandfather or grandmother related fairy tales and ghost stories in the fire glow. In this passage, Marie brings up the importance of fire on Halloween, and Blue Skull mentions it in their story too, saying that his family always lit a fire on Halloween. And indeed, they had one going as the knocks were being sounded on their door. Part of the purpose of bonfires was to keep bad or malicious fairies at bay. Makes you wonder what would have happened if Blue Skull hadn't had a fire going that night. Other means to keep the fairies happy and at bay was to leave them food. Usually it was either left out on the table after dinner or on the front doorstep. I'm not aware of any traditions regarding burying food like they did in the story, so maybe that's a custom that's unique to their family. The author did say that burying the item was a key distinction that you're leaving a treat for the dead. I was thinking maybe that's because the dead are buried? That would be my guess. They also said that they found that the dead, or whoever the offerings are for, have an affinity for apples. I can't speak to that, but apples were used a lot during Samhain festivities because they were one of the harvest foods of that time, along with nuts. So a lot of the games played incorporated apples, like bobbing for apples, which carried through to American tradition. I don't know if it really still goes on much today, but I remember it being a thing when I was a kid. Also, there was a game called the peel game, which was where you peeled an apple in one long, continuous strip, and then you threw the peel over your shoulder in the hopes that it would fall in the shape of a letter, which would be the first letter of your future spouse's name. So, in the story we read, Blue Skull and their wife heard mysterious, soft knocks on their door. Three knocks at a time. A superstition I've explored in a previous video, which was called Harbingers of Death, is that three knocks on a door signifies a death soon to come. Luckily, it doesn't seem like that happened. However, there is another possible option. When they first heard the knocks on their door, they suspected that maybe it was trick-or-treaters. It was Halloween, after all. Maybe they were right. The origins of trick-or-treating come from a practice in Ireland called rhyming, or sometimes mumming. where bands of children dressed in false faces, basically wearing a mask or something to conceal their face, and they would wear costumes and go from door to door. Not necessarily just on Halloween, but also on the days leading up to it, and they would perform for a treat from the homeowner. In my hometown, everyone is expected to tell a joke when they go to someone's house, something that I always thought was really annoying growing up, but I have a better appreciation for now that I know that it actually is pretty reminiscent of the origins of Halloween, and it makes sense that you should perform for a treat and not just, you know, hold out your hand and get some candy. So the rhymers would perform music or skits or, of course, would recite rhymes. Here's one of them that I found. Halloween knock, a penny, a stock. If you don't let me in, I'll knock, knock, knock. If you haven't got a penny, then a half penny will do. If you haven't got a half penny, then God bless you. I thought that one was particularly interesting given that in the story they hear three knocks on Halloween nights, and this rhyme says, if you don't let me in, I'll knock, knock, knock. In reward for their performances, the rhymers would get fruit, nuts, or sometimes money. This was in rural Ireland, so there wasn't a ton to go around, but the kids were happy with anything. Here's another cute but devious little rhyme. Here comes I, wee devil doubt, the worst wee devil that ever went out. It's money I want and money I crave. If you don't give me money, you'll go to your grave. And if you didn't give the rhymers a reward, a treat, or you didn't answer your door, they would just beat down your door, knock on your door, maybe rifle through your cabbage patch and grab a head of cabbage and throw it at your door. Nothing too terrible most of the time. Maybe a broken window, accidental fire, but nothing too sinister. Here's another passage from Jack Santino's The Hallowed Eve. A man from Malligan, County Derry, age 70, says that the rhymers saw themselves as representing the fairy tricksters thought to be roaming on that night, quote, pretending we were wee folk, end quote. An identification that validates the pranking and other license that the youngsters partake in. At the same time, they might rub salt and meal on their heads to protect themselves from real fairies. And, really quickly, this last bit I just read is referring to a custom of rubbing a mixture of salt and dry oatmeal into a child's hair to protect them from being kidnapped by fairies on Halloween night. Quote, the American trick-or-treating custom is similar in this regard, insofar as people wear costumes that identify them with marginal, dangerous, and tricky creatures associated with Halloween, and thus they can behave in socially inverse ways. End quote. With that, I think we will move on to our next story. I am going to be reading now from the Fairy Census, which, if you don't know, is a collection of 500 first-hand encounters with fairies anonymously submitted and collected by folklore historian Simon Young. There are two of these now, and I'm going to read from the first census, which was published in 2018. We'll start off with a brief account. This one took place in New York State in the 1990s, when the witness was in their 30s, and the time was between midnight and 3 a.m. I hadn't gone to sleep yet in my in-law's house, though my husband was asleep beside me. The shades were pulled down, and the room was completely dark. A small ball of light suddenly appeared and began to move around the room. I watched it move to all different parts of the room. Then it came toward me and hovered before my face. I could see a human-like shape inside the light. Then it drifted away, and after a moment, it disappeared. This happened on Halloween night. Balls of light are pretty common when it comes to different paranormal phenomenon, be it ghosts or fairies or aliens or even Bigfoot. So this story makes me wonder, what details people who witness balls of light are missing when they don't see them up close. Because this one had a little figure floating inside it, and that's something that I don't think the witness would have seen unless it was up in their face like it was. They also don't give a lot of details, and they do make a note that they could not see it clearly. The being, I'm guessing. There's a question on the form when you're submitting an account to the fairy census that asks, what made you think this was a fairy, as opposed to a ghost, alien, angel, or something else? To this, the witness responds, I guess it was the seeming curiosity of the creature that made me think it was a fairy. Another question asks, what are fairies? And this person writes, fairies are natural beings that exist in both our world and their own. And of course, this happened on Halloween night. And it's no secret, as we've discussed, that fairies are said to be much more present and active on Halloween. So, moving right along, let's go on to the next account. This one also took place in New York State, sometime between the year 2000 and 2010, when the witness was in their 30s, and the time was between 9 p.m. and midnight. It was the night of Halloween. My housemate and I had been handing out candy to neighborhood children for the last few hours. I had a bit of a headache, so I excused myself and went out the back door of the house into my backyard. I was just standing near the door, enjoying the fresh air, when I heard a rustling from the furthest corner of the yard. We don't go back there very often because it's got an odd sort of off feeling to it. It's overshadowed on three sides by tall trees, a tall fence, and the wall of our garage. Nothing we've tried to plant there ever grows, although the wildflowers seem to thrive. Before then, we just ignored that corner. We didn't even mow the lawn there. Anyway, I heard rustling in the leaves on the ground, which we didn't bother to rake, either, and I thought a neighborhood cat was skulking around back there, so I walked over. It was dark, but there was enough light from the lamp over the back door that I could see four or five little shadow figures. They were like miniature people, about 2 feet tall, but composed entirely of darkness, darker than the surrounding shadow. There was another sound over my head, like a gasp. When I looked up, there were more of them in the trees and on the roof of the garage. They weren't shadows. They were three-dimensional and moving around. I've never seen anything like them before or since. I don't remember what I thought or felt, but I ran back in the house. After a few minutes, I came back outside. They were gone. Or, at least, I couldn't see them anymore. But I left them with some wine and food I had in the house. Apples, bread, nuts. Everything was gone the next morning, although I guess it could have been squirrels or rabbits. Were they fairies? I don't really know. I do know that they were not human and also not a trick of the light. I never saw them again, but I've continued to leave food for them every Halloween, and it's always gone the next morning. I didn't tell my housemates until the next day. To me, that story has just a great little spooky Halloween ambiance to it, and I felt like I could picture the setting and the atmosphere very, very well. And I did think it was interesting that the food that they left out for the fairies were apples and nuts, which, like we just talked about, were the food that was used on Halloween a lot because it was the harvest food. So that's kind of interesting to me that those were two of the foods that they left out for the fairies or whatever they saw. I want to read some of the responses to the survey questions when submitting the story that this witness filled in. When asked to describe the fairies, she says, they looked like little miniature people made of three-dimensional shadow. I know that's not quite the conventional description. And it's not really an unconventional description when it comes to other supernatural phenomenon like shadow people. I don't know if it comes up too much when it comes to describing fairies. I could be wrong about that, or maybe forgetting a story I've read before where that exactly comes up. But it's not a way that I remember hearing fairies described of often. But still, I like to think I can picture what she meant pretty easily, and it kind of made me think of, especially the way they're up in the trees, of Kodama from Japanese folklore, the little white humanoid creatures that are in Princess Mononoke, and they're usually pictured as white, but if I picture them as being all black, that's what I was thinking of. The witness's response to what makes you think they were fairies is, they may not have been fairies, but they were definitely some type of earth spirit. At least, that's my gut feeling. I know they're still there. There's a feeling you get in that corner. A few people have remarked on it. It's kind of a solemn, serious feeling, like you're disturbing something when you go back there. I don't know about angels or aliens, but I've seen what I think were ghosts, and they were nothing like these beings. Let's break down her answer a little bit. She said, they may not have been fairies, but they were definitely some type of earth spirit. I think a lot of people would consider those to be one and the same, that fairies are earth spirits. They definitely seem to be tied to nature, be it trees or flowers or aspects of the landscape or weather. And actually, when asked, what are fairies, she writes, fairies are earth spirits. So I think what she means is that not all earth spirits are fairies, but all fairies are earth spirits. So whatever she saw may have been a fairy, or maybe it was some other type of earth spirit. But that's just my guess at interpreting her answers, and I'm sure she's just making guesses to identify what exactly it is she saw. But it's fun to pick it all apart, right? So, moving on in my dissection, she remarks on how that back corner of the yard just feels off, and that's something in her roommates have agreed on, and that other people have even commented on. I personally think corners could be kind of predisposed to be a thin place, because they are a place of intersection, a meeting place where two things come together and touch. Not so different from a crossroads, which are said to be magical and supernatural hotspots. That's something that's been established throughout different cultures' folklore. So maybe that corner feels off because it's a little patch of otherworldliness, or it's kind of a thin spot, and I would think that has a strange feeling to it. These little shadow beings didn't seem to threaten the witness, but who really knows the nature and intentions of fairies? She knows enough to leave out food for them on Halloween and to treat them with respect and caution, as she goes on to say in her final remarks. I don't know if this account is useful to you or not, but I thought I'd share it in case it is. I've lived in this house for more than 10 years now, and the earth spirits in the back have been both helpful and at times vindictive. Fortunately, not to us, though. My housemate and I try to be respectful as you can be to something whose culture you don't understand, and give them a wide berth. To me, there's no question that this account is useful, and I know Simon Young agrees. After all, it is printed in the fairy census, so for him and others interested in researching this topic, it provides a lot of insight and data in regards to the intended purpose of the census, which is to gather data on the modern attitudes towards fairies. Interestingly, this witness's modern attitude largely resembles a traditional attitude practiced by the rural people of Ireland and many other cultures across the world, which would be leave out offerings, be respectful, and keep your distance. For someone like me, and maybe like you, this account is important because I find it fascinating, and I love hearing people's accounts of strange, inexplicable, and otherworldly experiences. It's relatable to people who have had these same kind of experiences, and to me it's just comforting and exciting and interesting to know and to think and to muse that these types of things happen to people, and we don't have it all figured out, and there's more to life that we just don't understand. All right, I am going to read two more stories, and these are going to come from a very interesting website called the Dukas Project. This is an Irish website, and the goal and objective of this project is to digitize the National Folklore Collection. There's a couple different collections they have on their website, and we are going to be reading from something called the Schools Collection. What the Schools Collection is in the 1930s, the late 1930s in the Republic of Ireland, the Irish Folklore Commission initiated this project for collecting folklore, and they passed out these notebooks to 5,000 primary schools and instructed the students of these schools to go out and talk to older people in their community and gather folklore, gather local recipes, local legends, local games, superstitions, and handwrite them in these notebooks. And so all of these notebooks are now digitally scanned, and they're on the Stukas website, and they're just absolutely amazing. I just love reading through them. So I was picking through all the entries in these books, these notebooks, on Halloween, and I didn't even get nearly halfway through. There's so much information and so many stories. But I have two really interesting ones that I want to read that I found so far. So I'm going to read the first one, and then I'm going to have my very dear friend James Gracie come on and read the second one for you. He is Irish, so I figure I would be remiss not to feature an Irish voice in all this amazing Irish history and custom. The first one that I'm going to read was collected from County Donegal by a pupil named Cornelius, who is recounting a story told to them by an elder local named Dennis Bradley, who was 70 years old. And this entry is called Hallow Eve. According to superstition, the fairies be out that night, and they would take you away with them if you were out at that evil time. It is also said that the devil comes around that night and shakes his fur on the haws and turns them black. And according to the old people, if you eat a haw after Hallow Eve night, you will have no luck and you will die young. I know a man myself named Patrick Cavanaugh who, when a boy, was herding cows on Hallow Eve and on losing one of them stayed out to look for it. Whatever way he got delayed, he was out to 12 o'clock. And as he was calling the cow, around came the fairies and took him away with them. His own people and the people of the neighborhood, missing him, away went out to look for him. But no matter where they searched, high or low, they could find no trace of Patrick. After the lapse of a few days, Patrick came back and told them what happened, and was able to tell them how he saw them looking for him and how he saw so. And after falling into a big hole, but being under a spell, he could not call out or make any sign to them, and all that he said happened to him was true. So, that is a real story about Halloween and the dangers of fairies and meeting the fairies on Halloween night. They did mention a little superstition about the devil coming around on Halloween night and shaking his fur on the haws, the berries of hawthorn bushes, so that if you eat these berries after Halloween night, you will have no luck and you will die young. This is a pretty common superstition about not eating fruit on trees or berries after Halloween night. And sometimes it says the devil spits on them. Sometimes it said the devil urinates on them. Or sometimes it's said that puka do this, puka, which is kind of like a goblin, very dangerous fairy in Irish folklore. That's a very common superstition about not eating fruit after Halloween night. And that's probably something to do with it being out of season after that time, I would think. And so you could probably get sick if you eat it. So, the next story is from County Mayo and was collected by a student named Ross, who says they got the information from their aunt. The entry is called November Night Stories. November Night was another common name for Halloween, just like Samhain or Hallows Eve, All Hallows Eve, and it's because it was on the eve of November 1st. So, this one James is going to read for us in his lovely voice.
Some years ago, on November's night, a lot of girls gathered together in one house to play tricks, as this was the custom. At 12 o'clock, the girl of the house went to the well for water. Her mother asked her if she would be afraid, and if so, to bring another one of the girls with her. The girl said she would not, because the moon was shining very brightly. She went off to the well alone. As she reached the well, she slipped and fell. This was very unlucky, as this was the night that spirits would have power over everything. When she got up and looked around her, it seemed to her that she was in a strange place. She stooped down for the can of water. When she had the can of water filled, she crossed the step, and as she crossed it, she saw a man standing beside her, dressed in white. She was very frightened, but she did not faint at first. The man asked her who she was and what she was doing there. The girl fainted, and when she came to herself again, he had disappeared. She came on another bit, and she had to then go through a wood. As she entered the wood, she heard some lovely music, and she listened and looked around every side of her, and she saw a great crowd standing at a blazing fire. Suddenly, she was placed in the middle of the crowd. They did not speak a word, but they kept looking at her. The poor girl was very frightened, but she found she could not move. At last, a big man came up to her and asked her to dance, and she said she would. At that moment, a red-haired man passed by very close and whispered to her, "Do not dance, or you will never reach your home again." So, the girl refused to dance. This made the fairies very angry, and a fierce man stood up and said, "Whoever comes to us must dance with us." Just then, the red-haired man passed by again, and he touched her on the arm and led her out from the crowd. He then gave her a plant, a small piece of ivy, and told her to keep it until she would reach her home, and no one would dare touch her for as long as she held this plant. So she went off through the fields in the moonlight, and all the time she heard footsteps following behind her. At last, she reached her home. She had just gone to bed when she heard the voices outside crying to her, "The power we had over you is gone, but wait till you come to us again. You will have to stay with us forevermore, and no one will be able to help you." The girl kept the magic ivy, and the fairies troubled her no more.
Oh man, that is just such a rich and fantastic story. I looked up the area that this story took place, which I believe is called Crumlin. I just punched it into Google Maps. And so if I have the right place, this place is so small and so rural. It's basically farmland with two roads running through it. So just to think that such a rich and beautiful story comes from just this tiny little area. It's so amazing. I just love going through these archives. I'm always saving interesting things that I read and interesting stories. There are so many fairy stories. I mean, every notebook is filled with stories, legends, and accounts regarding fairies. So it's definitely something I'm going to come back to. They're amazingly rich and beautiful. I'm so glad that they were taken down and preserved and available for people to read through today. One thing I will mention before we move on is that so this girl who was found herself among the fairies was given ivy by this mysterious redheaded man. And whether this man was another human who had been captured by the fairies and just wasn't able to escape on his own for some reason, or was a kindly fairy, I'm not sure. But he gave her ivy, which was able to get her home and protect her. So I did find a couple mentions in folklore about ivy being protection against sorcery. Not really specifically with fairies, and there isn't really a lot of extensive reference and information I could find about that superstition. But I did think that was interesting, a little plant lore there. Big thank you to James for reading that story for us. Love him very much. I will put the link to his blog, Behind the Couch, in the description, and this is where he writes film reviews. He often highlights independent horror films, Irish language horror films, other interesting, obscure, independent foreign films. And he's always recommending so many good sounding films to me, although sadly I'm not always able to see them because they don't have a wide release. But a great one I did see recently that he told me about is called Caveat, and I highly recommend it if you want something really kind of strange and different and spooky. Definitely spooky. So thank you again, James. He pops up every once in a while on my videos and uploads. So it was a pleasure to have him. So, as you can see, fairies and Halloween really go hand in hand. This has been the case since the dawn of the holiday, and it appears that it continues to be so. Welsh writer Marie Trevelyan says that October is regarded as a month of mystery. I love that. And I totally agree. There's just something about it. Always loved October, especially Halloween, but the whole month. Nowadays, I guess that's reinforced by the existence of Halloween and all the atmosphere that that implies. But surely, Halloween, Samhain, No Skin Calangaif, and all the other iterations of the holiday were known as spirit days for some reason. That brings us to the end, and right about up to Halloween, which is just in a few days at the time of this posting. I hope you enjoyed the stories tonight, and also enjoyed learning a bit of some of the customs and history surrounding this strange and wonderful holiday. I will be back with more stories soon. So, until next time, take care, and happy Halloween. Good night.